Let's move on into the imprecatory psalms. Others will call these the cursings in the psalms. Why are there certain cases in the psalms of cursings, cursing the enemies of God? For example, Psalm 58, verse 10, it says that the righteous will rejoice when he sees the vengeance. He will wash his feet in the blood of the wicked. Psalm 68, 21, surely God will shatter the head of his enemies, the hairy crown of him who goes on in his guilty deeds. God's going to just completely destroy them. Psalm 109, 12, let there be none to extend loving kindness to him, nor any to be gracious to his fatherless children. I hope that you are killed and there's no one to father your kids. Psalm 137, 9, how blessed will be the one who seizes and dashes your little ones against the rock. Just grotesque cursings here in the Psalms. Well, critics point out, doesn't this contradict Jesus' teaching to love your enemies? You know, maybe, okay, let's just say, for example, those people deserved that. Okay, I don't even know how that would work, but they deserved judgment. But didn't Jesus say we should love our enemies, not should we pray that people would be murdered like that in a gross, grotesque way? Well, a number of observations can be made regarding the imprecatory psalms, the cursings in the psalms. First, if you noticed, these prayers encourage divine judgment, not human judgment. It's very different. They're not praying that they're going to go through and kill somebody or judge someone. Instead, they're trusting that God will be the one to go through and do that. For example, many of these are given right from the pen of David. And yet, if you look at David's own life, he refused to kill Saul with his own hand. He wouldn't go through and take justice into his own hands, especially when he knew that God had appointed Saul to be king. He trusted that God was going to do that in his own timing. Second, the prayers that encourage divine judgment like this actually are repeated in the New Testament. There are many, many, many examples of prayers for divine judgment. For example, Jesus himself said, the same one who said, love your enemies, is also the same one who commanded his disciples to curse cities who did not receive the gospel. That people who did not receive God's message should be cursed. Jesus himself cursed such cities, Matthew 11, 21, and he cursed people. Read through Matthew 23, where he curses the kind of religious authority at the time. He goes after the religious authorities and curses them. We see in the New Testament as well, Paul cursed people for volitionally defying God's will and for false teaching. In Galatians 1:6, Paul says that anyone who preaches another gospel should be anathema. I did a word study on that in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible. The word anathema is the word used for the ban, the judgment in Joshua. In other words, it means divine judgment. Paul said that people should be anathema. And he said that in many other passages. 2 Timothy 4:14, he's referring to Alexander the coppersmith, who God will judge. So we shouldn't take matters into our own hands. That's what the Bible teaches. And yet there are prayers in the New Testament. Here's another one here in Revelation 6. It says that the martyred saints cried out for the divine justice. How long, O Lord, are you going to wait to redeem the blood of innocent people? Even the Lord's Prayer, our Father who is in heaven, your name is holy. It says, your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Think about what Christians are praying when they pray that. Here's the way John Wenham comments. He says, when we pray, thy kingdom come, we pray for the overthrow of evil. We know that the answer to that prayer will be partly by grace and partly by judgment. It is not for us to choose which it shall be. We are strangely inconsistent in our attitude to prayers for judgment. You see what he's saying? When you're saying, thy kingdom come, thy will be done, you're praying for judgment. I don't know if you realize that. When we pray for victory in war, even if it is a prayer with many qualifications in it, we are praying for the forcible and painful overthrow of the enemy. We are not usually so realistic and perhaps so honest as the psalmists, and do not picture even to ourselves what we are actually praying for. We are praying that the whole pitiless machinery of war may go forward to bring, if possible, a speedy conclusion. Okay, third, the subject of mercy and forgiveness exists in the Old Testament as well. It's not as though this is an Old Testament versus New Testament problem. We've already shown that prayers for divine judgment exist in the New Testament as well as in the Old. And yet we can also point out that the subject of mercy and forgiveness was also in the Old Testament as it is in the New. Leviticus 19:17, "You shall not hate your fellow countrymen in your heart. You may surely reprove your neighbor, but you shall not incur sin because of him. You shall not take vengeance nor bear any grudge against the sons of your people, but you shall love your neighbor as yourself. I am the Lord." Proverbs 25:21, "If your enemy is hungry, give him food to eat. Feed your enemy. And if he's thirsty, give him water to drink." Give food and water even to your enemies. Do not rejoice. Proverbs 14:17. "Do not rejoice when your enemy falls, and do not let your heart be glad when he stumbles, or the Lord will see it and be displeased and turn his anger away from him." Do not say, "I will repay evil." Wait for the Lord and he will save you. Proverbs 24:29. "Do not say, thus I shall do to him as he has done to me. I shall render to the man according to his work." Job 31:29. "Have I rejoiced at the extinction of my enemy or exalted when evil befell him? No, I have not allowed my mouth to sin by asking for his life in a curse." So we have this idea of mercy and forgiveness. Guess where that comes from? It comes from the Old Testament as well. Well, how then do we harmonize these passages with the idea of loving God and caring for even our enemies? Well, if you notice, most of these prayers in these passages are not petitions. It's not as though the person is praying, asking God that he will do this. In most of the cases, the person is trusting that God will do this. Based on God's own character, they're taking solace in the fact that even though evil has happened, God will take care of these people. So they're not asking, they're trusting. Children were judged along with their families. So we see in Noah's case, in Genesis 7, Noah was rescued. That meant his family was rescued. He was the head of his family. Likewise, Achan in Joshua 7, he was the one that blundered and a bunch of people were killed because of what he did. It says that not only was he judged, his entire family was judged. Most likely because of the goods that he stole were in the family tent. There was no hiding. They were all culpable. But that's the point, is that if a person was judged, the entire family was judged as well. And then finally, the nations were cruel and barbaric in their judgments against Israel. The reason why these prayers are so extreme is because they're praying against some of the cruelty that was done against Israel. When the Babylonians conquered Israel, they were unusually cruel to the children, the women, killing the men, leaving families fatherless. God actually says, "I'm going to use Assyria and Babylon as a tool, as my hand in bringing judgment. But they're going to overdo the judgment. And then I'm going to go through and judge them as well." So the psalmist is reading these passages saying that they were unusually cruel. And he's trusting that God is going to come back and bring judgment on these people. Agonizing over the suffering, trusting that God would make sense of that. Okay, let's consider the subject of polygamy in the Old Testament. Polygamy, having many wives. There are roughly 30 references to polygamy in the OT. And many people wonder, you know, is it okay to have many wives? Okay, the New Testament says that it's certainly not okay to have many wives, but why does the Old Testament have so many occurrences of this? You know, for example, Abraham, Solomon had an entire harem of women. You know, Moses, it seems like a ton of different people had multiple wives. Well, to explain this, we could use that rule of thumb I mentioned earlier, that description is not the same as prescription. The Bible records a lot of things that it does not condone. The Bible records Satan's lies. The Bible records evil, suffering. You know, in the book of Judges, some of the most disgusting things, I don't even want to repeat them, they're so awful. But it's there to describe the fallenness of humanity. So while it's describing what's going on, it's not prescribing. It's not giving a prescription for what should be occurring. Secondly, in regards to polygamy, we can point out that the original marriage between Adam and Eve, the original concept for human relationship, is monogamous. We see in Genesis 2:24 that a man shall leave his father singular and his mother singular and be joined with his wife. So it doesn't say he shall leave his father and mothers or his fathers and mother. It says one father, one mother, and be joined to his wife. Well, you might be saying, well, that's in the Old Testament. That, you know, that doesn't matter. Well, I would have tons to say about that, but let's just make it real easy. Jesus affirms it. Jesus affirms it in Matthew 19. He says that the concept for divorce is based not in Deuteronomy 24, the case law. It's based in the original creation. He quotes Genesis 1:27, that they shall be made male and female, and also Genesis 2:24, that they'll leave their father and mother and be joined. Literally, they shall cleave to their wife. Moreover, we can look through the stories where polygamy occurs in the Old Testament, and we see in every story it ends badly. Look through, read through your Old Testament and just see how many headaches these men get for multiplying wives. I don't even think I need to belabor that point. I think if you've read the Old Testament, you understand what I'm saying. Most of the problems arise from having multiple wives. That was not in God's will. Fourth, polygamy is arguably banned in the Old Testament law. I'm saying arguably, not certainly, but arguably banned. Leviticus 18:18 states this: you shall not marry a woman in addition to her sister as a rival while she is alive to uncover her nakedness. Okay, this is why this is disputed. In Leviticus 18:1 through 17, all of those commands refer to incest. Okay, so the context leading up to verse 18 is about incest. And then verse 18, you shall not marry a woman in addition to her sister. Well, people say, well, that's referring to incest, not polygamy. However, verses 19 and following refer to non-incestuous sexual relationships. So this is kind of sandwiched right in there between incest and non-incest, and it's debated as to which one it means. Well, this phrase, a woman in addition to her sister, or the opposite, a man in addition to his brother, is used exactly 20 times in the Hebrew Bible. That exact phrase, a woman in addition to her sister, a man in addition to his brother. It never once refers to a literal brother or sister. It always speaks of just a brother, like a person in Israel. You shall not sin against your brother, not your fraternal, literal brother. So that's disputed. However, the law did do away with polygamy for the kings in Israel. The king explicitly could not have many wives. Deuteronomy 17:17, the king shall not multiply wives for himself, or else his heart will turn away. But Solomon had 1,000 wives, and that was wrong. He shouldn't have, according to Deuteronomy 17. In fact, the king had to go through and read that law and memorize it. What about Proverbs 5:15? Drink water from your own cistern. It's kind of a proverbial way to describe you shouldn't be going into other people's cisterns. Stay in your own cistern. That's in the Old Testament as well. Well, why not more explicit condemnation of polygamy? You know, once we get to the New Testament, it's very clear. An elder is supposed to be a one-woman man. You should not have multiple wives. You should have one wife. The original creation was one father, one mother, monogamy. Why doesn't God take a stronger stance on polygamy in the Old Testament? Well, it might have been a lesser of two evils at that time. In this society, men were constantly being wiped out due to warfare. There was a higher population of women to men. As the Beach Boys put it, two girls for every guy. Okay, in that society, men were being wiped out pretty regularly. And to be a woman, to be alone without a husband, was basically equal to destitution. I mean, you were in poverty. It was difficult. You couldn't provide for yourself in that culture at that time. Now, look at Ruth in the book of Ruth, is destitute. She needs someone to care for her. And could have been that God just permitted this practice, even though it wasn't ideal. It might be better to have basically share a husband rather than just be destitute. So he may have just not talked about it at this point in history because it was a lesser of two evils. That doesn't mean he approved it. Doesn't mean he liked it. It's clear he didn't, but he may have just permitted it, as we've been making the case for the other things going on in the Old Testament law. What about rape in the Old Testament? Does the Bible condone rape in the civil law? Could it be? Deuteronomy 22:23, it says, if there is a girl who is a virgin engaged to a man and another man finds her in the city and lies with her, then you shall bring them both out to the gate of that city, and you shall stone them both to death. The girl, because she did not cry out in the city, and the man, because he has violated his neighbor's wife. So if a woman is raped, it's not just the rapist who gets punished, it's the woman as well. Well, actually, this is not describing rape, okay? This is describing adultery. Basically, when a woman was betrothed, when she was engaged, that was pretty similar to being married at the time. This is describing adultery, not rape. I'll explain why. This act, this sexual act, occurred where? In the city. Finds her, quote, in the city and lies with her. So they're in the city, a populated area. Then it says that she's punished. Why? Because she did not cry out in the city. Do you see what he's saying? There were people around. If this was not consensual, then why didn't she scream and people would have heard her? I mean, it's not like they had soundproof apartment complexes. They had tents. You'd be able to hear what was going on. She could have cried for her life. Okay, the next passage deals with an entirely new situation. Deuteronomy 22:25. Now, this is describing rape. We read, but if in the field the man finds the girl who is engaged and the man forces her and lies with her, then only the man who lies with her shall die. But you shall do nothing to the girl. There is no sin in the girl worthy of death. For just as a man rises against his neighbor and murders him, so is this case. So this is describing rape. Notice, it's not in the city. Where is it? In the field. Some guy must have lured a young girl away from the community, out into the field. And it says that he forces her and lies with her. He raped her. Okay. Well, the punishment is only the man is punished. He is executed for that. That was a capital crime in Israel. He will be killed. Well, why? You'll do nothing to the girl. There's no sin in the girl. For just as a man rises against his neighbor and murders him, so is this case. Murder is the same as rape to God. That is how vile it is. And then in verse 27, we read, when he found her in the field, the engaged girl cried out for help, but there was no one to save her. That's the difference. She was in the city. She didn't cry out because it was consensual. Out there, they're saying she couldn't have helped herself. Far different from the ancient Near East. Here's what Copan says on page 140. Middle Assyrian laws punished not a rapist, but a rapist's wife, and even allowed her to be gang raped. So you wouldn't just punish the rapist. In fact, he wouldn't get the punishment. You'd go back to his wife. Isn't that sick? In other ancient Near Eastern laws, men could freely whip their wives, pull out their hair, mutilate their ears, or strike them. A dramatic contrast to Israel's laws, which gave no such permission. The law in Israel, if you were around at the time, you'd want to live there because of the protection involved. Okay, then the third case in Deuteronomy 22, verse 28. If a man finds a girl who is a virgin, who is not engaged, and seizes her and lies with her, and they are discovered, then the man who lay with her shall give to the girl's father 50 shekels of silver, and she shall become his wife because he has violated her. He cannot divorce her all his days. This is probably something similar to statutory rape, okay? We'll explain why. Or just fornication. These two people are sleeping together. Okay, the girl's not engaged, is what it says, but it says they, plural, are discovered. Both of them were found out. So it's just two people, unmarried, sleeping around together. And it says at that point, the man has to come forward and pay the father. Now, people think, is that cheapening this girl that you're just basically throwing money? Is she a prostitute that you're just paying off the situation? No. Unlike our culture, which is, you know, anything goes sexually in our culture. You know, it's just not uncommon whatsoever for people to sleep around. In that culture, if a woman was supposed to get married and she had not saved herself for marriage, it was thought to be dishonorable. The girl probably couldn't get married, or she had to bring a huge dowry to make up for that. So in this case, this guy ripped off this girl, and he had to front the money and provide that money for this girl's future dowry. It was making up for that. And it says at that point that the father and the daughter get to decide if she wants to be married, and he has to marry her. You can't just use somebody like a Kleenex, throw them away, and move on to the next person. According to God, our sexuality is important to him, and we can't just be using people. So that was the law at the time. Deuteronomy 20, verse 13, another passage which is on rape. When the Lord your God gives it into your hand, this city, you shall strike all the men in it with the edge of the sword, only the women and children and the animals and all that is in the city. All its spoil you shall take as booty for yourself. So when you take over this nation, these people, if you attack a city, you can take over their women and children. That's booty. That's for you. And you shall use the spoil of your enemies, which the Lord your God has given you. Jump over to verse 21, or chapter 21, verse 10. When you go out to battle against your enemies and see among the captives a beautiful woman and have a desire for her and would take her as a wife for yourself, then you shall bring her home to your house and she shall shave her head and trim her nails. Verse 13, she shall also remove the clothes of her captivity and shall remain in your house and mourn her father and mother for a full month. After that, you may go into her and be her husband, and she shall be your wife. So when you take over another city, if you find a chick pretty, you can take her. She's yours. And yeah, it's just describing, you know, just military rape. You could go into another society and you split up and say which women you want. It's just talking about that. Well, verse 14, it shall be if you are not pleased with her, then you shall let her go wherever she wishes, but you shall certainly not sell her for money. Okay, so you can't sell her because you've humbled her. Okay, you can't sell her as like a sex slave. Okay, this is a troubling passage. Remember, we have no problem saying that. Principle number two states that this is not the final law of God, it's the first law, right? It was trying to limit brutality, not completely get rid of brutality. At the time, you know, military rape was par for the course. That's the way it was at the time. God was trying to limit that. So we have no problem saying this law is brutal or barbaric. And then remember principle three. This is an example of case law. God's not condoning going in and taking a woman from another society, but he says, if this happens, this is what should happen. That being said, let's make a number of observations which show that this was actually light years ahead of the cruelty and barbarism at the time. First, the woman wasn't raped. I don't know if you noticed that. She was brought in to the person's house and she was made a wife. It's not as though they were grabbing women and raping them. Second, the foreign woman was given 30 days to grieve. Now, at the time, if you took somebody over and there was a woman that was beautiful and you were stronger than her, you wouldn't wait 30 days to rape a woman. That would happen immediately. God was saying she gets a full month to grieve. And then third, we have to point out that women who were taken over at this time would have been destitute. Think about it. The alternative to being taken into a Hebrew man's house and made a wife was to be thrown out on the street and be completely impoverished and destitute. And at that point, we could also say that these women were treated as wives, not as sex slaves. It's interesting that he has to marry her, not just use her physically. It's showing that even these women who were taken over were placed on a high level. And it says, if you're not pleased with her, you can't just crumble her up and throw her away. You must stay with her. You can't sell her for money. There's no such thing as that in Israel. So while it's cruel, while it's barbaric, it was light years ahead of what was going on at the time.